Hello and welcome to Health Fact versus Fiction, brought to you by HCA Healthcare UK. I'm Anna Richardson and this is the podcast where we uncover the truths and bust the myths about your health with some of the country's leading consultants. Men, what exactly do you know about your prostate? Do you even know where it is? And don't just say that it's somewhere down there. It may be the case that the only thing you do know about your prostate is that it can be a little bit problematic from time to time. In fact, prostate cancer is the UK's most common male cancer, with one in eight men likely to get the disease in their lifetime. So today we're going to be probing the prostate and giving you everything you need to know to be able to spot and tackle problems early. With me throughout this episode is Mr. Ben Chalicum. Ben is a consultant urological surgeon at the Prostate Centre, a part of HCA Healthcare UK. Ben has recently also written an article with Stephen Fry about the operation he performed to remove Stephen's prostate cancer last year. Ben, hello and welcome.
Hello.
Now, I'm going to ask you about the article you wrote later on, but let's start busting some myths. So, can you tell me if the following statements are health fact or health fiction? You look slightly terrified, Ben. It's okay. Don't worry. You can perform under pressure. Number one, all men have an equal chance of getting prostate cancer. Fact or fiction?
That is fiction. All men can get prostate cancer, but some men have a higher risk than others. And quite importantly, men from an African or Caribbean background have a higher risk, double the otherwise background risk. And men who have a family history of prostate cancer also have a higher risk. And of course, it is possible for men with an African and Caribbean background to also have family history, which gives them a quadruple risk.
Wow. That's incredible. So actually, it's really important for men with that particular ethnic background to get themselves checked out.
Yeah, absolutely. They would be our sort of national top priority for getting checked and assessed at an early age.
Number two, a man would know if he has prostate cancer because he'll have very obvious symptoms. Fact or fiction?
Yeah, that unfortunately is fiction, because it is quite possible to have quite significant prostate cancer and not have any symptoms. And this is mainly because of the fact that the prostate cancer generally grows on the outer part of the prostate, and the water pipe goes through the middle of the prostate. And therefore, it's only when the prostate cancer gets to a significantly bad stage that it presses on the middle of the prostate and causes symptoms. So unfortunately, many men with significant or bad prostate cancer don't know about it because they have no symptoms.
Number three. A man's risk of getting prostate cancer increases if his mother had breast cancer. Fact or fiction?
So that's fact, and that's quite an interesting one, and one that we're sort of learning more about in recent years. We know prostate cancer is a hormonal-based cancer, and therefore the risk of breast cancer, which is another hormonal-based cancer, does impact slightly on a man's risk. There are a rare group of families with the BRCA gene, which is one of the very dangerous hereditary breast cancer genes, that have a much higher risk of prostate cancer. But thankfully, that is quite rare. But overall, any man who has multiple cases of breast cancer in the family is at a slightly higher risk of prostate cancer.
Well, Ben, can we just start with some basic biology first of all? What is the prostate? Where is it? And what does it do? I mean, we hear an awful lot about it, but I haven't got a clue what the prostate does.
So the prostate is a gland, and a gland generally makes stuff. So what it makes is it makes most of the fluid that is in semen. It doesn't make the sperms themselves. They're made in the testicles, but the tubes from the testicles go up through the prostate, and the prostate makes about 90% of the seminal fluid. It's always described as being about walnut size, but that would be a sort of a small to medium prostate, and they can be larger. And it lies really between the bladder, the bottom of the bladder, and the water pipe. And the water pipe goes up through the penis and then out into the air. So it sits in a particularly deep and difficult to access part of the male pelvis.
So why is it that as you get older, men tend to get complications with their prostate gland?
Well, we say there's only two things that grow in a man as they get older. It's your ears and your prostate.
No. Is that true? What, your prostate grows?
Absolutely. And part of the problem is that the effects of the natural body's testosterone, for reasons that we don't completely understand why they work more in some men than others, enables the prostate to grow, particularly in the 50s and 60s, and often then presenting with problems in the 70s and 80s as it gets quite big and swollen.
And if you do experience problems, it's not necessarily cancer. I mean, I know you said it's in a very difficult and deep part of a man's pelvis, and that the cancer tends to grow on the outside of the prostate. So it isn't necessarily symptomatic, is it? So if there are problems, what could it be?
So the majority of men who have prostate symptoms, or what we would call in urology lower urinary tract symptoms, and by that I mean difficulty starting to wee, difficulty getting the wee out, difficulty in emptying the bladder, and associated a little bit with getting up at night and going frequently and without much warning, all of those symptoms in a man are very often due to enlargement of the prostate, i.e. a problem with getting the wee through the prostate and out into the water pipe. Prostate cancer generally doesn't cause many symptoms until it is relatively advanced and pressing on that pipe. And of course, both these conditions are common. So it is possible that a man can have an enlarged prostate and prostate cancer. And we do see that not infrequently.
But it's not necessarily the case that if they have an enlarged prostate that it is a cancer issue. It's just that they've got an enlarged prostate, and that is a common...
Yeah, there is no increased risk of prostate cancer because you have an enlarged prostate. They are conditions that run alongside each other, and they're not interrelated. That one doesn't cause the other.
If you do have an enlarged prostate and it is not cancer, then what are the treatment options?
So the first treatment option is really what we would call conservative measures, which is basically trying to work out ways that you can alter your lifestyle and fluid intakes to make sure it doesn't affect you as much, i.e. perhaps cutting out caffeinated drinks, perhaps not drinking too much in the evening, perhaps making sure you drink quite a lot of fluid through the day, and avoid things that might otherwise irritate the bladder and the prostate, which can be some spicy foods and fizzy drinks. After that, then there are a range of medicines which can either relax or shrink the prostate in order to try and ease the symptoms by basically helping to open up the pipe going through the prostate to alleviate some of these plumbing-type issues from the narrowing. And then beyond that, for people with more severe situations, there are a whole range now of different surgical, that many of them are minimally invasive surgical techniques in order to in some way widen the pipe by either burning away tissue or vaporizing tissue or holding back the prostate in order to, again, cause a similar but more marked effect by opening up the pipe to allow the urine to come out normally.
How would you know that there might be a problem?
So I think if your symptoms have come on relatively recently, that's often a bit of a red flag that something has happened in the last few months or 6 months or so, in terms of getting up more at night, having a marked reduction in your flow, a feeling of incomplete emptying or difficulty in starting or being able to start. If you're the sort of chap who's in a urinal in a pub or a sports ground or a theatre where you're still standing there and other men have come in, had their wee and gone out and you're still there, these are the kind of situations where you probably need to go and get that evaluated by a urologist after the GP.
Well, I was going to say, when should a man go and see his GP? At what point should he be concerned?
So new onset symptoms, significant symptoms that don't respond to these basic conservative type measures. And we should also add in there, if a man has a urine infection, that's pretty unusual. Men should go and get that evaluated. And if a man ever had any blood in the urine that they could see, they definitely need to get that evaluated, because that could be a significant problem with the urinary system.
What can men expect when it comes to being checked out? Because I imagine that some chaps are a little bit anxious about where the prostate is located and how it's going to be examined.
So the prostate's in a particularly awkward part of the body. It's placed down in the pelvis, and the only real way to feel it and to feel the edge of it is to place a finger inside the bottom, up through the anus into the rectum, and feel forwards to what is sometimes a sensitive area. Now, this only takes about 20 seconds. It has no real lasting after effects. And for a man who has a PSA test that is elevated, it will allow us two real pieces of useful information for me as a doctor. Number one, it tells me roughly the size of the prostate, and we will therefore potentially know therefore whether that PSA is appropriate for the size of the prostate, and we'll be able to feel potentially any nodules or irregularities on the prostate. And obviously a nodule is a bad thing to feel.
What should a healthy prostate feel like then?
Well, here's a weird one. It feels a bit like touching the tip of your nose. And it should be, and that's how we train the medical students, it should be a roughly that sort of consistency. Soft but slightly firm underneath, but without any actual hard nodules. And the prostate's got two lobes or two sides to it, so usually you can feel both sides and then a little depression in the middle. And what it shouldn't feel like is hard and nodular and craggy. And prostate cancer does grow on the outer part of the prostate, as we've spoken about. And so the majority of prostate cancer that is significant or major, one would actually feel from a rectal examination.
Can you talk to me about what the PSA test is? Because I've heard this banded about in between the male members of my family, but I don't really know what it is. What is it and why is it important?
So PSA is prostate-specific antigen, which basically means prostate chemical or prostate marker, something that is made only by the prostate. But it is not prostate cancer specific. It is just a marker that something is going on in the prostate. So every man with a prostate will have a recordable PSA level. But it is used as a potential marker for finding prostate cancer because it goes up with prostate cancer. It does, however, also, frustratingly, also go up with an enlarged prostate or if there's any inflammation or infection in the prostate. So we call it in sort of statistical terms, it's quite a sensitive test, i.e. it responds to things going on in the prostate, but it's not a very specific test, i.e. it doesn't tell you exactly what thing is going on with the prostate. So I would say at the moment the overall view in the UK is that this is a starting test and that further evaluation needs to be done for a man with a raised blood level of PSA rather than just assuming that it is any one of these particular diagnoses.
Now, we have touched on the fact that if you are experiencing symptoms, it doesn't necessarily mean at all that you have cancer. In fact, often a cancer will be symptomless. But for 1 in 8 men, it will be prostate cancer. How would you know that it's there? Are you scanning? Are you doing some kind of MRI scan? How do you actually locate it?
So the current gold standard evaluation would be usually after a PSA test for a man to have a special type of MRI scan of the prostate called a multi-parametric MRI scan, which basically means multiple views on an MRI scan, and then to go on to have some form of biopsy, increasingly done through the skin of what's called the perineum, the skin of the undercarriage, as opposed to the sort of old-fashioned way, which is through the skin of the back passage, the rectum. And then with those two pieces of information, we will know, i.e. the grade and the stage, which, again, for urological jargon, basically means how bad it is and how much there is of it. And if we know how bad it is and how much there is of it, we can work out what would be the best treatment for an individual man.
Does that necessarily mean that you've got to have it removed?
No, not at all. In fact, removing it would only be an option in probably a quarter of men presenting with prostate cancer across the country. So at least a quarter to a third will be found with what's called low-risk disease, i.e. it's not particularly bad and there's not very much of it. And they would then be placed on a program of surveillance, of monitoring, which would involve repeated MRI scans and potentially repeated biopsies. And although quite involved for the man, it does spare them any of the side effects of treatment for a disease which almost certainly isn't going to kill them. Because low-risk prostate cancer is very slow-growing, it's very indolent. Some urological experts sometimes have debates about whether it really is cancer at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And therefore, it's actually seen as a particularly bad thing to be aggressively treating low-risk prostate cancer, unless it's in men with special circumstances.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it sounds as though you're saying that many men are not going to have any idea at all that they might have prostate cancer, number one. If they do have prostate cancer, then it could be the indolent, very slow-growing one. So is there a case for saying that actually sometimes you don't need to treat these things at all? It's not going to kill you.
Yes. Well, we feel that the majority of men on surveillance will not come to treatment. And this is one of the great sort of paradigms of prostate cancer and the frustrations is that many more men die with it than from it. About 42,000 men a year in the UK get prostate cancer, but only about 10 or 11,000 die from it. So a lot die, but it's only a quarter of the total number.
So when would you decide something's got to be done about this?
So if on that evaluation of how much is there and how bad is it, if you are further up the scale on that, such that you have what we would describe as intermediate or medium to higher risk disease, higher risk prostate cancer, then you go through a process usually involving a discussion in a team meeting, which we call a multidisciplinary meeting. It's pretty standard across various different cancer groups. And we will then recommend usually a variety of different treatments that may be suitable for that man. So unlike lots of other cancers where one treatment is usually chosen by that group as the primary one, in prostate cancer, we may say they're suitable for surgery, but they would also be potentially suitable for radiotherapy and also perhaps for seed brachytherapy type radiotherapy.
I was just going to stop you there and say, just talk me through those treatments. What do they mean? What do they involve?
So surgery for the prostate is called a radical prostatectomy. Radical is just a sort of jargon word for meaning doing surgery for cancer and involves taking out the whole prostate. Some men will say, why can't you just take out the bit with the prostate cancer in it? And the answer is that you can't really join it back together if you take out half of the prostate, and you can't see prostate cancer with the naked eye. So you're never quite sure that it's all out unless you take out the whole thing like the shell of a walnut or a fruit. That increasingly in this country is done with a robotic assisted approach, which basically means with a special type of keyhole surgery using at the moment a Da Vinci robot. And so 90% almost of the surgery done to remove the prostate for prostate cancer is done with that system. And that system, I think there are about 80 now in the country, is pretty much widespread across the UK. And we think that's the best way of doing it in terms of the best outcomes and the best recovery for men going through that. For the other options, radiotherapy is usually given as a course of treatments over traditionally 6.5 weeks, but now can be 4 weeks. And that is given in combination with some pills which block the testosterone system of the prostate. If you remember at the beginning, we talked about how prostate cancer was a hormonal type cancer. If we block the male testosterone, the prostate cancer kind of goes to sleep. And it's prepared biologically to accept the radiotherapy, i.e. the radiotherapy works better if you combine it with the hormone treatment. Now, this, of course, has the recognized side effects of reducing a man's testosterone and is only a short to medium term thing, usually for 1 or 2 years. But that then, coupled with the radiotherapy, is again another non-invasive way of treating the prostate cancer. The third more common way, or most common way in the UK of treatment, is something called brachytherapy, which is placing radioactive seeds into the prostate. The idea being that these little radioactive seeds emit a cloud of radiation which kills the prostate cancer around it. And that is a very elegant treatment, but unfortunately is only available to a relatively small group of men because you need to have very mild urinary symptoms or no symptoms, a pretty small prostate, and a number of other factors to be sort of suitable for that. But that is another good recognised treatment.
And depending on what treatment you have, what are the chances of making a full recovery?
So if your prostate cancer is caught early and it's still contained within the prostate, whichever one of these treatments you have has got a very high chance of curing it normally, at least 80 and sometimes 90% cure rate.
So it's a very, very treatable cancer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And added to that, it is, of course, possible to have other treatments down the line if, unfortunately, the first treatment is not curative, which can still, number one, may still offer cure, i.e. having radiotherapy to mop up any cells of cancer after surgery, or even having surgery, which is after radiotherapy, so having a second line curative treatment. And then further down the line after that, there's still the option of going back on the hormone treatment. And then we've got two now pill-based chemotherapy treatments that are approved nationally, and then standard chemotherapy after that. So very few men diagnosed with contained prostate cancer will, if treated effectively, will die of prostate cancer.
And during treatment, how is a patient going to feel? Do they feel rubbish or is it manageable?
In men who've had a surgery for prostate cancer, it's now really they're just in hospital for 1 or 2 days. The national average is only 1.5 days. And they have a catheter in for a week, which is a bit rubbish. And it's quite difficult to get around that because the catheter helps with the joint to bridge the gap after the surgery. And most men are only off work for 3 or 4 weeks and they have small holes and pain is really gone after about 4 or 5 days. And so there's not an ongoing effect from of side effects generally. However, the main thing men would need to do after the operation is to get used to the new continence or controlling their continence. And that's one of the things we focus on now is really training men prior to the operation to strengthen their pelvic muscles.
How on earth do you do that? Because as women, we hear a lot about having to strengthen your pelvic floor. I had no idea, again, that men would need to do that.
It's usually the moment in the consultation when I look to the woman, if there is one next to the man, and say, you'll know about pelvic floor exercises, and they usually smile knowingly, and I gather that they probably go and have a conversation with the husband then about what that means. But seriously, our nurses would train the men going through this process in order to try and strengthen their muscles in the run-up to surgery, and then train them again once they've been through it to try and maximise their recovery. And there are some good apps as well online now that you can get to kind of help with the pelvic floor strengthening, reminders and sort of telling you how much to do and how often to do them.
So how does that work for a guy then? I mean, how is it the same as for a woman? Is it sort of lift and hold?
Yeah.
I'm doing it now, by the way.
Yeah, I can see. me too. No, it's so the statements we make to men in order to try and help them work out what to do. And there's some interesting research on this. You have to use phrases such as try and draw your penis inwards, try and lift your pelvic floor up from the middle of the seat, or try and stop yourself from breaking wind. And all of these things will resonate more with some men than others. But essentially, you're trying to clench for 2 or 3 seconds, usually in a set of 10 exercises, that pelvic floor muscle down in the deep part of the pelvic floor.
So you were talking about how men feel during treatment. We got as far as if you've had surgery. So if you've had any of the other treatments, how do they tend to feel? Is it manageable?
Yes, it would be highly unusual for somebody not to get through the treatment. So for radiotherapy, your hair doesn't fall out. It's not chemotherapy. You don't feel generally unwell. The absorption of the radiotherapy after about the third week, you can feel it more in that men get more tired. But it would be unusual for men to not be able to work through the period of them having the radiotherapy, i.e. they can continue if they're in an office-type job, they'll be able to continue with that. And it can be scheduled at the beginning or end of the day to try and minimise the disruption. Then there are longer-term effects of radiotherapy is that it can have effects on the bowel by making the bowels, making you pass motions more frequently with less warning. And that sometimes is long-standing, but usually wears off after about 6 months and can be similarly can sensitise the bladder. So give you a bit more frequency of passing urine, a bit more frequency and urgency to get up, perhaps at night or sometimes in the daytime. And again, that usually wears off, but it can be relatively long-lasting in some men.
Now, something that men are going to be very concerned about, I imagine, is how this is going to affect their sex life. So what do you tend to say to patients?
So after surgery, it is likely that the erection nerves will be affected, at least bruised and reduced, certainly for the first few weeks and first few months. So we have a phrase called penile rehabilitation, which basically covers a range of treatments that are open to a man in that recovery period, whether they have been treated from surgery or from radiotherapy. Number one are pill-based treatments, which will augment or enhance erections. And they can be taken in the post-treatment period in order to try and basically encourage the nerves to grow back and to develop, and also to allow men to have that additional boost to get them back up to having intercourse and having sex.
And they could still achieve orgasm?
Yes. Now, they won't be fertile, i.e. no sperm will come through, no seminal fluid will come through. They'll have what's called a dry ejaculation, but they will still be able to have an orgasm.
Well, that's the end game, isn't it? Can you talk to me a little bit about your work with Stephen Fry, because you were the surgeon that operated on him to remove his prostate cancer.
Yes, it was quite an interesting time, as you would imagine, when his name comes up on the list of cases. And he was treated last year at the Princess Grace Hospital and came through things very, very well. And in the aftermath of that, I asked him through a publisher that I knew who works for Nature whether he would be interested in writing really about his experiences from the point of view of a patient. To some extent, really the unheard voice in a lot of prostate cancer management, what it's actually like for a patient going through it. And that I would then reflect on that from a point of view of a surgeon looking after an individual patient. And so we published a little piece called Both Sides of the Scalpel, which was published in Nature Reviews Urology. And it subsequently, I hope, will act as a resource for men going through this who have a similar, may or may not have the same, but a similar experience, to look at all the different time points that cause anxiety, the day of the diagnosis, the day of the test results coming back from the scans, the day of the surgery, the day of the results after the surgery, and then the sort of rehab afterwards. And I think he's a lot funnier than I am in it, but it's still quite a good piece.
Well, there is a link to the feature that you guys wrote in the show notes to this episode, so listeners will be able to read that.
Great.
As well. Do you think that the fact that Stephen has talked so openly about his diagnosis helped to get more men in to the doctor to talk about their concerns?
Yes, he released his side of the story in April last year, around March and April last year, at exactly the same time that Bill Turnbull came out and announced that he was having prostate cancer treatment. And a piece of data came out showing that prostate cancer had actually gone past breast cancer in terms of diagnoses. And I think the triple hit of that raised the awareness through the UK to unforeseen new levels. And what we found, those of us in the NHS, which I am mainly, that the huge surge in referrals across the country meant that the whole NHS cancer pathways were almost sort of creaking as a result of this. It's become known as the Turnbull-Fry effect, or the Fry-Turnbull effect. People have written papers on how this impacted on a lot of these diagnostic pathways. And the interesting thing is that this wasn't just a 1 month phenomenon. There is a continued lasting effect of more men per month coming forward, having been diagnosed, having been tested,
which can only be a good thing.
Yeah, so Stephen was initially slightly mortified by the fact that he'd seemed to have caused a lot of extra work, but I was reassured him, and I think he now is happy to see that many more men have been picked up at an early stage. Awareness, of course, doesn't happen incrementally. It sometimes happens in jolts and bursts, and that's what we had, and I think it's ultimately been a very good thing.
And just talking about ultimately being a very good thing, Ben, what advice would you give to a man listening to this podcast who wants to keep his prostate healthy?
So this is a common question that a lot of men have. What can I do, doctor, in order to lower my risk of having prostate cancer specifically or enlargement? We do think that a few things will be quite useful in the longer term. Number one is having a relatively high amount of fresh fruit and vegetables in the diet, and having quite a low amount of processed food, and particularly red meat. We think that that is not good for prostate cancer. We think men should drink plenty of fluids, and that we should be relatively well hydrated. And that goes along a theory that if the prostate is inflamed, then it's more likely eventually to become cancerous. And therefore that men should drink not a huge amount, but at least a litre to a litre and a half of clear fluids through the day. There are no specific sort of herbal or medical remedies that people can take. But I would also say that men who feel that they are, who are anxious about having prostate cancer, although the PSA test is not an ideal test, it is at least a starting point. And I would encourage men who are particularly in the high-risk group to go to their doctor and have a test, because at least they will then be able to know their own risk.
What age do you recommend that chaps get themselves checked out?
Well, we have no national screening program in this country because we don't have a test that is better than PSA, which is what we need. But for the men who are in these important risk groups, who have either got a family history or from an African and Caribbean background, then we would recommend that they're checked at least by the age of 45 in terms of having a blood test and or a rectal examination. For the rest of the of men in the population, the recommendation of our sort of national prostate cancer risk awareness program that the NHS has published is to have a test if they're worried around the age of 50. Although there is some evidence that having a test even as young as 40 will allow us to work out the sort of long-term risks of subsequently going on to get prostate cancer. So as a 46-year-old, I've had my PSA done, but I have a family history, and therefore I felt it was important to get checked, and that's what I tell my patients.
So that's very interesting because, you know, again, as a doctor that deals, well, as a urologist that deals a lot with prostate cancer, you have to practice what you preach. So how frequently should you get yourself checked out?
So if your levels are very low, and by low for somebody in their 40s, I would mean sub 1, then I think you can be reassured for several years, maybe 3 to 5 years. But the cutoff in your 40s, the age-specific level is 2, and for 50s is 3, and for 60s is 4. So if you're sort of 1.5 getting up towards 2, then perhaps you want to get that checked every year or every other year in your 40s just to keep a gentle eye on it.
And just to be absolutely clear, men in the high-risk group are who?
Men with a positive family history, so who have a brother, a father, or an uncle who's had prostate cancer diagnosed at an early age, and men of an African and Caribbean descent who are also at a higher risk. The combination of those two things, and men who have a high prevalence of breast cancer and particularly BRCA positive genes in the family.
Ben Challicombe, Consultant Neurological Surgeon at HCA Healthcare UK's The Prostate Centre. Thank you very much indeed. You'll find more about what we've talked about in this episode on our website, hcahealthcare.co.uk/podcast, where you can also learn about HCA Healthcare UK's world-class, award-winning private hospitals, specialist clinics, and private GP services across London and Manchester. And if you're listening on your favourite podcast app and like what you hear, why not leave a review? We'd love to know what you think, and it helps others find the podcast more easily. Health, Fact versus Fiction is presented by me, Anna Richardson, and is a Bengo Media production for HCA Healthcare UK.